The Road to Rock Podcast.
Welcome to the Road to Rock Podcast. I'm Elisa, and this is the podcast that goes behind the scenes of the rock music industry. This week's guest on the Road to Rock is Nathan James, the frontman and founder of British hard rock band Inglourious. Nathan made a name for himself when he appeared on the first season of British TV show The Voice, where he went up against a judging panel including will.i.am and Tom Jones. He then went on to appear on Superstar, which was Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber's TV search for the role of Jesus in the UK arena tour of Jesus Christ Superstar. Although coming close, he didn't win the role and instead went on to tour the US with the multi-platinum selling Trans-Siberian Orchestra. In 2014, Nathan founded Inglourious. They burst onto the UK rock scene, quickly getting added to the Planet Rock Radio playlist and securing support slots on tour with the Dead Daisies and Steel Panther. They went on to release more music and play some of the UK's biggest rock festivals. But in October of 2018, after recording their third album, Ride to Nowhere, both Inglourious guitarists and the bass player all quit the band on the same day, leaving only Nathan and drummer Phil Beaver as the last remaining members. A media frenzy followed when the former bassist gave an interview to Sleaze Rocks, criticizing Nathan, Inglourious, and dismissing the band as Nathan's project. A short time later, a YouTube video emerged of Nathan lashing out at his former bandmates and accusing them of using his name to get media attention. Nathan later apologized for his comments and the video was taken down, but the damage was already done and Nathan's reputation in the rock music world was in tatters. An onslaught of online hate and abuse ensued, which escalated to the point of Nathan receiving death threats. Within months, Nathan had reformed Inglourious with new band members, and in February of this year, they released their new album, We Will Ride, which went to number one in the Amazon Hard Rock chart. A few weeks ago, I caught up with Nathan for a brutally honest chat about everything that went on with his former bandmates and the treatment he received from fans and the media after it all happened. We discussed how he put his band back together after the fallout and went on to record the new album, socially distanced, through the first lockdown. Nathan's bonus episode of Fishbowl Roulette is at the end of his interview. This is where guests of the podcast answer random questions drawn from a fishbowl. Find out who Nathan thinks is this generation's Michael Jackson.
The Road to Rock.
So my first question for you is, what were you like as a child growing up?
I was quite dumb. I wasn't particularly bright as a child.
What?
I know, which was a relief for my parents when they realised I could sing, because, like, I think they were worried about me. I just didn't do very well in school.
That's, like, the last thing I expected you to say.
Yeah, I wasn't bright in school. I'm not bright now, but I've got lots of, what do they call it, common sense. I was quite outgoing, obviously, and then the moment I discovered singing, it all kind of changed. I turned into a nightmare, really.
Right, because this is why I was asking. I was wondering if maybe you were always a performer, like maybe you were into your amateur dramatics, performing arts kind of stuff. Were you like that?
Yeah, like literally the day I realised I could sing, I haven't stopped singing since that day, and I was probably about 10.
And how did you realise you could do it?
My headmaster at school, at primary school, kept me behind after an assembly, and I was like, oh no, what have I done? Like, thinking I'm in trouble. And he had a guitar and he was playing and he was getting me to sing. And he was like, sing this. And then he called my mum in after school and was like, I just wanted to tell you that Nathan can sing. And that was really like weird. And he said, I'm putting him forward for a school concert. They're doing, it's in front of 1500 people. And I got a solo and I was like 11. So it was like from that kind of moment where he kind of like believed in me, then I went on, I joined the Berkshire Boys Choir and I joined the Berkshire Youth Choir and did all these kind of huge, great big choral things. From then on, I just loved it. Then I went to part-time stage school. And
how do you think he knew you had this talent that you didn't even know yourself?
I was loud. I was the loudest singer. As a kid, like I was always just, even if it was Kumbaya, do you know what I mean? It'd be loud. And I was in tune, which I think is the key to singing, right? Like it's being aware of when you're in it or out of tune. And yeah, he knew from that. And I kind of knew as well, because I loved how it made me feel, truthfully. Like, I just loved, I loved the actual sensation and the endorphin rush you get from singing. I still do now. I'm still in love with it.
And what about, was it rock music that you were kind of, I can't see that happening in a choir, unless that's the best like school of rock choir ever.
No, I wish. There is lots of awesome choirs now, actually, that are a bit more rocky. But back then, no, it was like very traditional. And I'm glad I had that training, though, because it really made me a very versatile, well-rounded singer, which means I can sing lots of styles still to this day. But yeah, it was really good grounding, and it was really good learning from people who had that kind of classical well. But yeah,
so how did rock music come into it? When did you start getting into rock?
When I was like 14 15, I discovered Freddie Mercury, and by that time I was like, I've been singing for a few years, you want to start showing off of it. I mean, I thought I was the bee's knees, like. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna like push myself. What is the hardest stuff to sing? And then I heard Freddie, and I was like, that's the hardest stuff to sing. Like, it is harder than anything else. He's doing things like Barcelona, where he's like almost classical, and then he does things that it's like proper screaming, The Show Must Go On, like all these amazing songs. And I set myself a challenge of being able to sing I Want to Break Free by Queen. And then once I did that, I was like, oh, I can sing all the notes in that now. I'm going to move on to another song. And then I just basically went through all of Queen's back catalogue and like taught myself to sing as high as Freddie. That was my goal.
And you did it. You nailed it.
It helped when I was a kid and puberty wasn't a thing, you know. That was easy. But then when my voice broke and I obviously had to leave the choir, it was a bit of a learning curve, like trying to discover this new part of my voice. But I got really lucky when my voice broke and that I actually still had the kind of register. And I had a singing teacher the whole way through. I've had a vocal coach from when I was about 14 to now, and it's the same woman. So she's seen me through everything. She's seen me through the highs, the lows, the days when you're on tour and you can't even speak and you're like, please help me. And then in half an hour on the phone to her, I can go out on stage and do a gig. Like, she's a genius. Yeah, Juliet Caton is her name, and she doesn't teach a lot now. She teaches on my recommendation. So if there's someone that I think would benefit from her, I'm like, look, Juliet, can you teach this person? But she's wonderful. She's saved my bacon many a time.
So obviously we know that you went and did reality TV. This is a huge thing for somebody who likes to sing rock, because reality TV doesn't like rock. We know this as rockers. First of all, the voice you went on to, and we see it even now. I think like a week ago, there was a girl on there doing rock songs. They just don't seem to like them. What made you want to go on there? Because being put in there to be judged is hard in front of millions.
Yeah, I think the reason why I did The Voice was because it was the first season of The Voice. So I had watched the American one and thought, wow, this is a really great premise for a show. Like, they're not judging you on what you look like. They're judging you on your vocal ability. I know I can sing. So I felt quite confident going into it. Also, I was scouted. So it wasn't like I just like rocked up at an open audition with 1,000 people.
Really?
Yeah. So like in my series, it was myself, a girl called Kerry Ellis, who sings with Brian May. She and I were on that first series and neither of us got through. And I remember just thinking, if you haven't got through and I haven't got through, something's going on here, because we should at least get through to the next stage. And it was the rock thing. I think they're kind of intimidated by it, because it goes back to that Freddie thing almost of, it takes a lot of skill to be able to sing that high and that relentless. And also to have tone and soul as well, which I believe I have. And I just don't know if they know how to handle it. Like, how would Will.i.am stand on stage next to me when I'm belting my face off? Do you know what I mean? Like, and be taken seriously going, yeah. Do you know what I mean? It just doesn't make any sense. Like, put me on stage next to Ann Wilson from Heart. You know what I mean? If you had a bit more rock representation on the panel, maybe it would be a different show. But I was kind of led there on the premise that they'd scouted me. They loved what I did. And then I didn't get through, and I walked off stage to another TV show ringing me saying, hi, would you like to be on our show? So it all
Was this superstar?
Yeah, the industry is very small. So as soon as I didn't get through there, everyone kind of knew in the business before it was even on TV.
Oh.
Yeah, it was, so I was getting phone calls for that. I got a phone call from America to join a band in America even before my TV show had aired, The Voice had aired.
So you obviously left an impression on somebody.
Yeah, there's lots of people there, you know. There's lots of people behind the scenes, all these things. And there's a group of people who, I'm not giving away the secrets of the show and I don't care, but there's a group of people on The Voice whose job it is to specifically scout talent every year. So there's someone sat at home probably right now on YouTube going, singer, songwriter, YouTube video, blah, 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 looking for people that they can contact and go, hi, do you want to come and be on The Voice? And then they'll probably end up getting shafted just like I was.
Do you watch it now, ever?
Sometimes, but I watched the episode you're talking of. The girl's called Kim Jeanette.
That was it, yeah.
And it was like watching my audition over again. Honestly, actually, I felt ill watching it because I was like, God, I know what's going to happen. I knew she walked out on stage. She was confident. She could sing. She looked awesome. She looked like a rock star. And I was like, you're going to hate her. And they didn't tell. So it's just, the show is very odd because to me, the whole concept of the show is flawed in that it's never made a star, because in order to be a star, you have to fully encompass what a star is. And that is stage performance, personality, performance in general, you know, connecting with a camera, all of these things that make a star. That show's never had a success story.
You're absolutely right. I can't think off the top of my head of somebody who's won it. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's been 10 seasons now, and you don't know one winner.
Yeah, at least on X Factor, you know a few names.
You know a name, and it's a really weird thing, because that's the one problem I have with it, is that it's a nice idea saying, oh, it's just about your voice, but ultimately, in the real world, to get on, it can't just be about your voice. You have to be a star, and that show doesn't find stars, it finds all right singers.
Yeah. And then, so you went and did the superstar one. I looked at the judging panel for that. And I know this is a few years ago. And obviously we look at where you are now. And I'm like, I'm sorry, Jason Donovan and Dawn French don't really understand where you're coming from. They can't appreciate a cracking verse of Guns N' Roses, can they? How do you feel on that?
I thought Dawn was an odd fit. And she was there because of... it was Looking for Jesus, obviously, and she was the Vicar of Dibley. I think that was kind of the...
Oh my God, is that the link?
Very loose link was that. However, I got why Jason was there. Jason played Joseph, okay, very famously. So he kind of did have a link, and he's awesome. He's a legend in that he had... I mean, his stories are amazing. I've got the most incredible stories I've heard from Jace. And he sold out Wembley Stadium. Not arena, stadium, back in the day.
As in, what, as himself, Jason Donovan?
Donovan, at the height of his fame. Like, he's a legend, right? So, when you, although obviously you're like, oh, yeah, what, Kylie and all those kind of bits and pieces. At the end of the day, he was one of the biggest stars of the 80s and early 90s. He's also, I think, the highest paid West End star of all time when he went into Joseph. At the time, he was on some enormous amount of money, which was like record breaking for the West End. So I loved Jace. And then funnily enough, I got asked to do the War of the Worlds, which is an amazing show to be a part of. I play every arena in the country, the O2 and MEN Arena, all this stuff. I did that 2 years ago and I got the job, and I found out Jason was in the show as well.
Oh, no way. So he remembered you.
Yeah, and he walked in on the first day of rehearsal. He was like, I can't believe, like, 7 years ago, I was sat there, like, he literally said, his coolest quote to me, actually, was that he said, I wish I had a tenth of the voice you had.
Oh, my God, what a compliment.
Yeah, which was really nice. And he was so great with me. But it's another TV show, right? All they did was try and pull me down and not like the fact that, oh, it's so weird. It's so weird talking about this. Andrew was so complimentary. He actually said to me privately that if I was around in the 70s, I would have been the voice that was on the album.
Oh, my God.
When you tell a 23-year-old kid that, who's in direct competition with 10 other guys, I loved that. I was like, yeah. I was like Conor McGregor. I thought I was untouchable.
Well, you would from somebody like that, yeah.
I kind of looked a bit like Jesus. I was like, this is a thing. Like, I'm gonna do all right here. And then it didn't go my way because I did just love it. I loved.
Who doesn't love being told they're good?
I know, but it's the British mentality, though. You can tell someone they're good, but as soon as they're aware of that, people don't like it, and it's like, well, what do you want from me? Do you want me to be shit and say I'm shit? Do you want me to be good but say I'm shit? Okay, cool.
Did you want to go and do stage, or at that point were you like, I want to go down the rock route?
No, I wanted to do music, but I had to redeem myself from The Voice, right? So I needed an outlet where millions of people would see me singing, and I got to sing on that show. And all the vocal performances, actually, I am proud of to this day. That was my one thing going into it. I was like, I'm not going to regret any of these. I want to nail all of these so that when I look back and when people see them on YouTube, no one can go, oh, he was crap there and he was flat on this bit. I was like, I'm not having that. I'm going to nail it. And I'm really proud of them still. They still make me happy. And yeah, it's pretty cool. It's so much fun being on TV.
Oh, I can imagine. Well, they gave you all the set and the dancers and the lights. And they are. They're all on YouTube. Everybody's still watching them now. Thousands and thousands of hits.
Yeah. Those videos got me in the position with the band I was in. When I was putting together, instead of sending someone a crappy demo you've done on your phone, I was able to literally send them a link to a YouTube video with a million hits and go, this is me, this is how I sing, do you want to be in my band? In a, like, what is this, 5-6 years ago when rock, that new wave kind of thing hadn't really happened here yet, that was very attractive to people, you know, like, knowing that like there was a singer who was actually actively wanted to sing rock and roll, had a rock voice, had long hair, like I ticked boxes. And it was, yeah, it definitely worked. And I had, as a result of that TV show and even The Voice, I managed to get the Trans-Siberian Orchestra in America, and I managed to put together my band here in the UK. And I also got a record deal off the back of that because they knew I had a following. So it all kind of did work out. It's just the most stressful time in my life, live TV. Live TV is, and it was every night. It wasn't like X Factor every week. It was literally Monday to Friday live shows.
I had no idea it was live.
So it's live TV Monday to Friday, and then I got kicked out on a Friday, I think. So I went on a massive, no, did I get kicked out on the Friday or the Monday? I got kicked out on the Monday, then I went an absolute raging bender that night. Was on this morning.
Please tell me it was with Jason Donovan.
Oh, I went out in Soho and got, for the first time and only time in my life, I got papped, which was like,
oh,
mental. I was proper like drunk coming out of a nightclub. And the next morning, literally like 3 hours later, I was on this morning sofa with Eamon and Ruth. And I remember they were sat there like, oh, like you've been kicked off the show. What are you going to do now? And I was like, actually, I'm going to America to do a 60-date US arena tour. And I just after that moment that I was with them, I actually had to go to the US visa office to get my visa. And I remember just thinking, God, this is like a movie. You know, like I got kicked off the TV show. Then I'm on This Morning with Eamon and Ruth hanging. Literally, I smelt so bad. Like I was so hungover. And I was staying with this dude and he was really skinny. And I had spilt drink all down my shirt the night before. And I was like, oh my God, what am I going to wear? The dude was like, take one of my shirts. And I was like, you're an extra small. I was like, there's no way. So on This Morning, I'm wearing this extra small mustard t-shirt that's like this. And I look so uncomfortable. I smell awful. And then I rocked up to the embassy, got my visa. And it was just such a crazy time. Like I went and got my nose pierced that same day as well. Because I was like,
because I'm that rock and roll. Yeah.
I got a tattoo and got my nose pierced the day after. So I walked back into the final and I had my nose pierced and I was just like...
Oh my God. Do you think... Who was the guy that won it?
He's a really good friend, Ben Forster. And he's great. He's perfect.
What does he do now?
Loads of theatre. So he's been... Since that show, he's been the Phantom of the Opera. He's been Buddy the Elf in Elf the Musical. He's been in Evita. He's done loads and loads of shows. And yeah, he's amazing. He's gone on to do great things.
Do you think that would be the path that you went down had you won it? You'd just be doing theatre. You wouldn't be doing rock festivals, download festival.
I wanted... part of me wanted to win because I love that musical. Like, it is a rock opera, really. And the part of Jesus is so cool. Judas is a better part, if we're being honest, you know? Like, he's more of a rock star, you know? But I would have liked to have done it because you've got to play all those amazing venues. So you've got to play the O2 and you've got to play all these great big rooms. So when I did finally get to play them 2 years ago, it was just the most... And to play them while stood on stage with Jason Donovan taking my bow, it was just like, wow, this is a real full circle moment. Like, I can't believe that I'm now doing that. And this isn't because of a TV show. It's because of my ability that's got me here, which was a really nice feeling.
And actually not that far down the line, only a few years later, not like decades and things like that.
The weird thing was going to America. So straight after I did Superstar and I got kicked off in quite a dramatic fashion, I did the 60-day US tour with the Trans-Siberian Orchestra, and I was playing to like 15, 18,000 people a day. And I just remember, this is better than the prize of winning that TV show. Like,
well, that's what I'm thinking. You came out with a better deal.
And I got my US visa and I did 3 years with them. We headlined Varken, which was like unbelievable with TSO. So yeah, like, I did some amazing things because of it. I definitely, it's hard in that moment when you've been kicked off a show and you're embarrassed and people will form an opinion on you, based on what they think they know and what they've seen, which they forget is edited. So yeah, it was really tough coming off that. But knowing that I had that to kind of like go to was just amazing. I could always, I just totally forgot the UK. I just went to America and I was like, bye, I'm not dealing with that nonsense right now. And then it was when I came back from there that I started up Inglourious.
And how was the early days of Inglourious? How did you get the members together? Did you have an idea of who you wanted?
It was, so an A&R guy scouted me through my management, and my management were like, okay, this guy wants to meet you. His name's Derek Shulman. And they were like, just, he's signed some big people. And I was like, okay, like, who's he signed? Like, whatever. And then you look him up and he's the guy that signed Bon Jovi.
Oh yeah, so it's fair enough.
He signed Bon Jovi, he signed Nickelback, Dream Theater, he re-signed AC/DC in the 80s. So he's a legend, you know, like,
he knows his stuff.
And he sat me down in a London hotel and was like, look, I love your voice. Like, I love everything about you. You're great. Who are your heroes? And I listed off my heroes, who were all David Coverdale, Paul Rodgers, Axl Rose, Freddie Mercury. He said, everyone you mentioned was a frontman in a band. And I said, yeah, they are. I didn't really want to be a solo artist. You know, I wanted to front an awesome band like all my heroes did. So it was then when he was like, well, you've got to find a band and you've got to write your songs. And up until then, I was like, oh, I'm not writing. I've never written before. I didn't feel like I would be able to do it well. So he pushed me to write and he pushed me to find a group of guys. So I put out like a worldwide search for musicians online. And I had people auditioning from all over the world, literally sending in videos. There's an amazing drummer actually called Aaron Spears, who drummed for Christina Aguilera and Usher. He was messaging me like, hey man, like, I've seen you sing, think you're awesome, like, I'd love to audition. And I was like all these incredible people. And it just didn't make sense. He was in LA, we're a young British rock band. I did want it British really as well. And then I set about finding it, got the guys. They all came to audition for what was my solo band at the time. And then it turned into Inglourious after that, when I came up with a band name. And one day I was just sat there and I was like, Inglourious. And then I said it to them and I was like, what do you think? They're like, yes, great. And I said, well, there we go. Went and bought the website domain that day, and then from then on it was all official. The beginning was tough in the financially, because I had the Trans-Siberian Orchestra money, which was amazing. I bankrolled the whole thing, so it was a big investment on my part. To make sure that everyone was comfortable, because I didn't want people to struggle. You know what I mean? There's nothing worse than like worrying about food when you're trying to like make a record, or worrying about your petrol money, or worrying about the fact that you only got scruffy shoes on. Do you know what I mean? So I tried to make sure that everything was in the beginning was as easy as possible. And yeah, it was tough. Like, it was really tough that first time. And I spent loads of money actually recording a solo kind of album with loads of guests. I had Gus G from Ozzy Osbourne's band on there and Mickey Moody from Whitesnake. I had four incredible drummers, Ash Sohn, who played on Skyfall for Adele. I had the best musicians in the world. And the guy, Derek Shulman, said he liked two songs out of the 11.
No!
And I was like, oh! I just spent like 20 something grand on it.
What happened to it? Where is it now?
In the can. It's there somewhere.
You must find it. He might change his mind.
One day I might release it, but it's also, it wasn't me writing the songs. So it didn't make sense really. And yeah, then learning to write songs was a whole different thing. Like,
I was going to say, if you hadn't done it before, how did you find it? Because it would be so hard to just sit there with a piece of paper and a pen and be like, I've got to make a song.
So intimidating when you're told that, because up until that point I'd only been a voice, I suppose. I'd been a vessel for other people's songs. I loved that because you could take your own interpretation of it. It wasn't you know what I mean? You weren't putting too much out there. You weren't being too honest, which from someone like me sounds slightly bizarre, but I really did struggle in the beginning with like being like, oh my god, is that shit, like, is this shit, oh no, like, I'm so embarrassed. And then when I wrote the first song on our first album with the bass player at the time and our producer, I wrote the chorus to Unaware, which ended up being a massive Planet Rock single. Like, it was on the A-list for something like 8 weeks or six weeks. And I remember thinking, god, that was the first song I ever wrote. So I obviously had a kind of hopefully a natural ability for it. And yeah, I think as it's progressed over the four albums, I feel like I've become a much stronger writer.
Well, in this album, actually, you've talked about Messiah being one of them, being inspired by the TV show on Netflix,
yeah,
and things like that. Is that where you take your inspiration, just whatever's around, whatever's going on?
It's usually from people. I like writing about people in my life, people that I know, because there's so many fascinating people, like, in everyone's lives. I there is in mine. You know, it's nice to write about people's relationships, or like, there's just so much going on around me. And then this time around, I didn't see any people for like a whole year. So I was like, god, who am I going to write about now? And so I didn't choose to be like, oh, I'm going to write a whole album on like documentaries. But it was more like, I found it fascinating. I found that TV show Messiah very fascinating because it was about a dude who like basically claimed he was the second coming, never proved it at all, but like all these people started following him. And I was like, how mental is that? That you can just go out there and like say, I'm this. And people are like, okay, cool, let's follow you. And that the God complex and the kind of sheep mentality I found really interesting. So that's what that song is about. But I thought it was a wicked show, really good.
I've not seen it. I need to have a look at this.
Yeah, it's a wicked drama and it's just beautifully shot as well, because it's half of it's like in the desert. And it's just, yeah, it's wonderful.
All right, I'll check that out. One of the other songs is about a red-haired lady who was beating your friend on a dance floor. This is where I see you saying about other people's relationships. That one, she won't let you go, right?
Yeah.
Please explain who this lovely woman is.
I'm never going to say her name because...
Oh, do you still know her? You're still in touch?
I'm not still in touch with her, no. And no one's actually asked that question. I've done 50 odd interviews now and you're the first person. But she properly kicked the crap out of my friend on the dance floor of the Monarch in Camden.
When you say kick the crap out of, I've got like dance-offs in my head and she just, oh no, she fully punched him in the face.
In the face, repeatedly. But my friend was so smitten with her that he was like, ha ha ha. I was like, this is not some sort of like kinky like thing that I've totally missed, is it? Like, I'm not going to kink shame anyone, but she punched you in the face. Like, it was just an odd thing to do. And so, yeah, I kind of had to write it about that. She was mental. And when I asked her, I was like, can you stop doing that? She was like, eh. And I was like, you're insane. I'm not scared of her, but I found it really odd. Like, I just remember thinking, god, my friend is so docile. Like, how can he just sit there and take that?
Well, the cover album, the artwork on the cover She's got red hair, and you said you kind of intertwined that with a couple of songs, Medusa. Do you think this woman is out there looking at that, hearing the song, and thinking, that's about me?
Oh, I hope so. It's nice, isn't it? I don't hold any like grudge against her. Do you know what I mean? It's just I found it is an interesting story. Like, but yeah, the kind of other characters, to be fair, that woman is representative of is a way more interesting. So Medusa, obviously, and Catherine Ferris, who I actually only discovered through, I wanted to write a song about like a highwayman. And after I wrote the chorus of We Will Ride, I was like, okay, I've got to find someone to write this about, like about horses. Who rides a horse? Where are they riding to? What have they done? And then I was Googling and I came across this one highway woman and she was so badass. She lost all of her fortune, her family's fortune. She was an heiress, had loads of money, lost it all and took to robbing people on the way to London and killing them. And I was like, she sounds amazing. Like, I was like, that's my kind of girl, you know? Like, so I just, yeah, I'm not condoning her actions, but again, interesting character to kind of like write about. And there was so much representation and focus on Dick Turpin and the kind of male highway robbers of that era. And I didn't know anything about her. And she was obviously even more badass because she was doing this, shooting people up, riding horses through the night, robbing people. And she was a woman. I thought it was pretty cool. Very ahead of her time.
Oh, yeah. And did you write it all in lockdown, the first lockdown?
We wrote some of it before then, but I finished the lyrics in lockdown, which was tough because I don't know about everyone else, but the first 8 weeks of lockdown, I didn't want to look at a bit of paper. I was like, what am I doing? I was like, why am I bothering? Why am I writing this album? I'm never going to gig again. The dates kept getting pushed back for the album. And I was just so, so depressed with like thinking that I wasn't going to sing in public again, that I just couldn't be asked actually. And then we finally got a date in for the album. And I was like, okay, let's do it. Like, and I sat down for like a good month and finished off all the lyrics. And yeah, just weird. Like those 8 weeks were so, I was just concentrating on being alive. You know, all my family came down here. I live in Devon and I live in a cottage next to my parents. This is my parents' house, not mine. But yeah, we had like 8 weeks together with all my brothers and their children. And it was just like, it was nice to, well, you just have to, we had to focus on staying healthy, right? That's what, like not catching COVID. So we properly locked down. I didn't leave the house for 8 weeks, even to go shopping. So yeah, it was tough. It's just tough to focus when you're like, when am I going to sing these songs again?
Yeah, because there was no light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, there is now, but back then, I mean, we never thought we'd get third lockdown, let alone second.
No, we all thought it'd be over by the summer. We'd be having Christmas light with each other. And yeah, this Christmas was just a write-off. Me and my mum got so drunk that we didn't see her Christmas Day. She was depressed because all of her kids weren't here, you know? Like, I know everyone's going through it all over the place. And it will be so good when we finally get out to play these new songs. We've got an album that people are loving, and actually play it in front of people again is going to be frigging awesome.
So recording it, did you record it in lockdown or was it that bit between?
It was in
lockdown. Right, okay. So you guys were a bit limited because I read that albums in the past, you used to all get together and go for it. No click tracks, no separate recordings. This one, you had to kind of do it separately because of social distancing. Is that right?
Yeah, that was a choice by the producer anyway, though. He would have had us do it. The reason why before we were all together is financially, it makes sense to track four things at the same time. Meant we got to use an amazing studio, which was Parr Street up in Liverpool, which is now sadly fallen victim to COVID, I think, and is being turned into a block of flats.
Oh, God.
I know it's not rock, but Coldplay recorded Clocks in the same room that we recorded in, which was such a huge album. And under the piano in that room, they've got a grand piano like this. And underneath it says Chris was here, where Chris Martin started it. Like,
the history.
And all of that's gone. And it's now a block of fucking flats.
Oh, God.
Fuming. So we kind of spent all the money on having an awesome room to record it in. And I knew that the guys at the band at the time could record it pretty much live. Like, there was, as far as like bass goes, there was like one bass overdub. So yeah, this time it made more sense to do it separate because that's how Romish, the producer, works. And I wanted this album to sound different. It had to sound different to like what had previously been, because it had to be so different that it couldn't be compared. that's what it's done, I think. Having Romesh, having an actual producer for the first time ever, and recording in this way, whereas usually on an Inglourious album you hear two guitars at one time. This time you're hearing like 10. It's just a bigger, heavier sounding modern album, and it's definitely been the right call, because we've not had a bad review, like, at all.
It's been huge. Yeah. So successful. And also, this is the first album that you've made with the new sort of guys in your band, the new lineup.
Yeah.
How do you all work together? How did you find those guys?
Well, this night when the red-haired lady beat up my friend, Dan, one of our guitarists, actually played in the band that play there. I don't know if you've ever been to Metal Works in Camden.
I don't think I have.
Awesome night. It's a covers band that have played every weekend for about 20 years on a Sunday.
Ah, Matt Pearce. He was talking about it in his interview. Yeah.
So Matt Pearce and Dan actually play in that band together. And I'd seen Dan there for years and years. And I was like, he's great. He's really good. But I thought he was like really, really metal. And I was like, oh, I don't know if he's like too metal like for us. Like, he was like, ugh. And then when the opportunity came up, he was like, please would you consider me? And I thought about it and I was like, yeah, like, absolutely, like, perfect guy for it. So I knew him anyway. We jammed a lot of times. I drunkenly sung Sweet Child of Mine with him about 10 times. So I was like, he's the guy. Danny, interestingly, was, when we started the band, Danny was 15, which is just hideous. And he did a cover of one of our first songs on YouTube. And I remember seeing it and being like, that kid is great. Like, this, like, baby Slash. I was like, he looks like Slash. He was in the video. He's playing the guitar. I was like, who is this kid? I bumped into him on our first tour in a vintage clothes shop in Birmingham. He was like, hi, I'm the guy from YouTube. I was like, oh, you're awesome. Like, love your video. Like, really cool. We kept in touch over the years. Then when he was old enough, he came on tour and teched for my last two guitarists.
Ah, so he's been in the background.
He's been in the background, and he teched for the guys for like a while. And then we became really good mates, and I was going to help him with a solo project that he was going to do. And we started writing. We actually wrote She Won't Let You Go together before he was in the band for that project. And I knew, literally, I was like, I drunkenly one day said, because I kind of felt like I knew that the guys were going to go one day, especially the guitarist. And I sat there with Danny and I was like, you're going to be in my band one day. You, like really pissed. And I knew it. I just knew he was going to be in the band. And he was the first person I rung when it all happened. And I was like, do you want to be in the band? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, we have to do that song that we wrote, which ended up being our first single from this album. So that's pretty cool. And Vinny, the bass player, I was suggested to by another Brazilian bass player in London who's like a bit of a like bass legend. He's played for loads of people. And I was like, I need a guy who can play rock, but who's also got a great understanding of music, someone who wants to be in a band, and someone who's a good dude, because I now had a bunch of people that I loved and trusted and I know as friends before they're in the band. That didn't really happen with the last group of people. It was who was the best musician for the band. You have to deal with the personalities after you've signed them up. Whereas this was like, I know you're a good guy. I know you're a good guy. And then Vinny was just the sweetest bloke. He's just so lovely. And he came in and fit like a glove. The first tour was a real success. And I think they knew as well, like, what an enormous amount of pressure it was for them coming into this, because they've got big shoes to fill. Like, I've never ever put down the fact that those guys were amazing musicians, and I've always been lucky enough to work with some amazing musicians. So they felt the pressure of like, okay, we have to be great live, and also when it comes to the album, we've got to write a great album with Nathan. And they did. Like, they absolutely did. Everyone was focused. And I think the coolest thing now is that this isn't a band of individuals. It's a band of people who want to be in a great band. And that's what I've said from day one, like in that first meeting with my A&R guy. I want to be in a band where the band is the star. And I kind of really feel that now.
Do you still talk to the guys that left the band?
No.
Okay. What was going on when it happened? Because obviously you had this tour and you were going to go out on the tour. Was there outside influences going on that was causing problems?
Everyone wanted to do their own projects.
Okay.
And I, the problem I had is that I don't mind people doing that, but to go about it and to time it so vindictively, I really struggled with. Because ultimately, it didn't work out in their favour because that release of that album was unsuccessful because everything that surrounded it. Whereas if they would have waited, it would have benefited them because we would have sold more copies. We would have had a great tour off the back of it. It was really odd, actually, because when they left, the next guys that came in did the best tour we've ever done. We had a really amazing London show at Shepherd's Bush. We did all these incredible festivals. We did, we did Grass Pop main stage, like. And that should have been those boys that were doing that because they were playing. It's just a really odd timing. And they all went to do their own things. They've got their own projects. The bass player wanted to be a front man, wanted to sing. And yeah, good luck because it's really hard. It's really hard starting again. It's really hard starting a band if you haven't got any money. Believe me. and it's really hard in this climate to get anywhere in rock. And yeah, I was destroyed. It's the lowest I've ever been. I lost a stone in 2 weeks. I drank coffee and was stressing out. It was when I was about to go on the War of the Worlds tour, and I was thinking, wow, this is amazing. I'm playing the O2 Arena. And every second of my day was spent reading. I was reading like awful things about me online. And then going on stage to play to 12,000 people. You know, it's just such a bizarre feeling. And also, and trying to put together the new band because there was no band. Like I was, and I couldn't, it's not like I can cancel the War of the Worlds tour. Like I was sat there thinking, God, how the hell am I going to do this? It was the biggest challenge I've ever had. And when we finally got on that tour and people were loving the lineup, I felt a huge relief. But again, all that anxiety built up towards the release of this album because I was like, okay, now I have to prove myself again. Like it's constantly like when I really struggled with that because in the rock community, I've always found it to be a very accepting place. And some people within that community during that time were really unhelpful and unsupportive, especially like some fans actually wrote awful things. I had fans who oddly like sent me an email yesterday apologizing for the way they acted. And you just think you should never have to do that. Like you shouldn't be in a position where you were fat shaming and where you were sharing videos of me online and saying I was vile and I was disgusting and I was an egotistical nightmare. I find it all really weird. I really struggle with that still. And I'm not, the problem is that I'm aware that I'm a lot of a character and I'm aware that I'm really confident. But if it wasn't just tell me to shut up, but I've constantly delivered. I've never failed you. And if I was some like deluded guy who had to like, who couldn't sing a note, do you know what I mean? Like I'd get it. I'd get how annoying I'd be. But I promise you, the more you hate me, the better I'm going to get. So just don't waste your time. It's really useless because I've clearly, I take all these hideous situations that I'm put in and I thrive because I have to, because this is my dream and nothing will ever get in the way of that.
It motivates you.
It has to, because otherwise it will kill you. And that's the reality. That's the reality of something like this, is that I wasn't aware that I was that famous, that people felt the need to send me death threats. I didn't know I was that famous. Because three guys left my band in a day, I was getting death threats.
That's disgusting.
Really?
That should never happen.
In the rock community, a community of people that I would have thought would have understood what bullying was about, you know, because we've grown up a bit different. We are the freaks, you know? We are those people that have struggled. We were outcasted at school because we had stupid hair or because whatever it was that made us different. And people were so quick to judge a situation they knew nothing about. I really struggle with that.
That's terrible. Do you think the press, I mean, the press love a drama. Do you think they really dug in on you as well? Do you think they've portrayed you fairly?
Well, no, because this is the thing, right? God, this is so hard.
I'm sorry.
I wasn't expecting this of you. Some were, some weren't. I think that's fair. I had people from magazines and radio stations, rock radio stations, sharing things on social media that I just thought was so unprofessional. And when a band comes along like mine, that is a great young British band, I expect everyone to be behind us. If you don't like our music, then fine. But understand that we're a young band trying to do something, and we're not shit. So try and get behind it rather than batting it down, given every opportunity. And it all comes back to that same thing about people really seem to struggle with the idea that I'm aware that I can sing. How mental is that? Why is it such a problem? And why do people struggle with my confidence? Because I would never, no one would take me seriously if I didn't. How do you tell someone you're a singer without going, oh, look, I'm a great singer. I'm really good at singing. If you want a singer, I'm your man. That's what I spent my whole life doing. And that's why from 15 to now, I'm 32, I've never done anything for money but sing. Ever. I've always sung for a living, be it in War of the Worlds, be it in a show, be it in Thrill Alive, the Michael Jackson musical, be it in whatever I've done, my voice has earned me money. So the one thing you can't say about me is that I can't sing. You can say my songs are shit, you can say I'm an arsehole, but I really struggle with what people, and also especially the rock community, like everyone like years ago was like, oh, we're just dying for another rock singer. The UK needs a frigging rock, they need a rock front man, like they need someone. Guess what? It's me. It's me. I sing, I believe I'm entertaining, I'm slightly controversial, I give you all the rock star things, and it just appears to be too much for some people. Which is odd, because they never said that to any of my predecessors. There was no social media. So I'm actually really envious of the David Coverdales and the Freddie Mercurys, because when shit was going on in their lives and they were changing lineups for whatever reason, or they were, I don't know, falling out of a nightclub pissed, no one saw it or commented on it at all. There was not a hounding of like, this person's a horrible person, we hate this person. This like hate campaign. What have I done? I sing rock and roll music. I'm not Donald Trump. You know what I mean? I sing rock and roll songs. If you don't like them, just stop listening to it. Like, turn it off. Like, fine, but don't actively go about your day trying to bring someone down who's just trying to make a living and also create something awesome. Sorry.
No, you nailed that. Well done. So I just need to ask you now, with it looking like we're going to get some kind of summer towards the end of the summer, where are we going to see you? Are you getting onto any festival lineups with the new album? What's going on?
The festivals will probably be next year, and the tour. So our tour was supposed to be starting in April. That's probably going to be a bit later than that now, because venues just aren't open. So I'm not going to say, I don't know. I'm just buzzing to like actually play these songs, you know, like it's going to be so cool to actually play the new material for people, because the reaction's been so great.
If somebody had never listened to Inglourious before, what three songs would you tell them they need to hear? Could be off the new album, could be off the old ones. What would you say?
Until I Die from the first album. It's got 4 million streams on Spotify. It's kind of our biggest single of all time. Then, oh gosh. He Will Provide off this album. It's really metal, and it shows you just how amazing the musicians are in this band. It's not just me who thinks I'm amazing. I think they're amazing as well. They're incredible. And the guitar playing in this album is second to none. And I've been lucky enough to work with some of the best, and these two guys are the best. They are the best. and Glory Days off of the last album, which is a really personal song to me. It's a ballad and it's about the breakdown of a relationship, and it's kind of the most personal I've ever been. I actually, during the recording of it, I started crying in the take that's used, and it's pretty much one whole take. So like the last like 30 seconds of it, I'm literally like, you can hear, it's so weird when someone's crying, but your larynx does this thing, it goes up, and I'm literally like properly afterwards, the guy just like, it's like, are you okay? And just turned the I had to go outside and like had a cigarette. I've never smoked in my whole life, but I was like, this is too much.
No.
I left everything in that room, and it was a real mad moment, actually, like proper therapy, because I never really dealt with that breakup properly.
Oh, okay. All right, those are the three we need to look out for.
The Road to Rock. Fishbowl Roulette.
Right, can I ask you a couple of these random questions?
Go for it.
All right, here we go. Okay, the song or album you played to death?
Album I played to death. Alanis Morissette, Jagged Little Pill.
Nice. Who would you like to collaborate with?
Lady Gaga.
Oh my God, I could see it. I could see it.
I think she's like the closest thing I think we as a generation have to like a Michael Jackson or something. I think she's a genius.
You're so right. I never thought about it like that before. Yeah. Have you seen her in concert?
Yep, 3 times. Love it.
Next one is, what do you want to be known for?
I want to be known one day as like the voice of rock. That would be like my dream.
Okay. This one is, what's your guilty pleasure?
My guilty pleasure is Michael Bolton.
Oh my God, I love Michael Bolton. I went to see him in concert, and it's all I could do not to throw my pants at him. His voice is so silky smooth.
One of my all-time heroes, and I've seen him. I met him once, and I've seen him like 3 times, and just unbelievable, Michael. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I like that. This one is, who do you think is at the top of their game in rock and roll right now? What girl and what guy?
Lizzie Hale. She's just the most badass freak on the planet. I love everything she does. Guy, I'm gonna go with a classic. I'm gonna say Slash. I think everything he's done, all of his solo stuff, is perfect. I think he's just a legend.
All right, your final one. What's the most memorable gig you've been to?
Oh, this is tough. It has to be the last gig I went to, which was exactly this time last year. I flew to Amsterdam to see Alanis Morissette in concert. It was acoustic in a theatre, and the tickets were a fortune. I was in the second row, and she sung the whole of Jagged Little Pill acoustic.
Wow.
And I was like, this is... I cried for the first 2 songs, and I was just like, this is amazing. Literally had goosebumps for the whole show. I know every word on that album, so like to me it was just like... I felt like I was in church or something. It was like, oh, this is amazing. Like, so good.
The Road to Rock.
A huge thank you to Nathan James for joining me on this episode of The Road to Rock. Since his interview, Inglourious have rescheduled tour dates for September and October of this year, and they're going to be headlining the Saturday at Call of the Wild Festival this summer. For more information, check out inglourious.com. If you'd like more episodes of The Road to Rock and to catch up on anything you may have missed, go to theroadtorock.com. The Road to Rock radio show is back this Wednesday at 9 p.m. GMT on Hot Radio. Listen online at hot.radio or on FM 102.8 and DAB across the south coast of England. Follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter under The Road to Rock.